You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, May 5th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor Kevin Cruz. On his book, One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. Also on the program today, the FEC, the Federal Elections Commission, surrenders. And in Congress, the TPP battle will culminate this month unless Harry Reid has something to say about it. And apparently, he very well might. Yes, that Harry Reid. This is going to be one of those situations, folks, where you appreciate somebody outside, as he's headed out the door, I think more than you may have when he was inside the door, wherever, whatever that room was. Also on the program today, Israeli-Ethiopian Jews clash with police. New study shows EPA's coal-burning regulations could save lives on top of saving lives. And that overtime pay bump, you may be getting one soon, ladies and gentlemen, by executive order. That and Mike Huckabee has jumped into the clown car. It's getting really crowded in there. And I will say that they all have a chance to amuse us tremendously over the next year or so, a little bit less. Oh, and the Pentagon is now sort of desperately, desperately asking people to stop assuming that Jade Helm is going to take over part of the country. We were on top of that story quite early. Was it Thursday of last week?
Yeah, but apparently this has been in Texas, in the West, this has been a theory for many months now.
Oh, I don't doubt it.
Definitely were one of the first media organizations to really...
Oh, I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it. I'm sure. I'm quite sure it has been percolating for quite a while.
Like, there have been people showing up at, like, community board meetings.
Right,
like,
of course.
Like, we demand to know what's going on with Jade Helm.
I always love the mismatch. Like, if something like this was happening, your community board is not the group to stop it.
Well, I don't know.
We have a petition from the
I got news for you.
Board
I can,
organization.
I'm going to say something that is going to be completely uncontroversial right now. That when Jade Helm does not lead to the U.S. military taking over Texas and Utah and California, then Alex Jones and every other moron who believed this was an issue will say that they have been successful. They will claim victory, and they have saved that part of America.
Well, yesterday we talked about how Ted Cruz said he asked the Pentagon about it.
Of course.
And the Pentagon said they're not planning a military coup. So Ted Cruz believes that, which, you know, if they were actually planning a military coup, they would just go, of course we're not.
Well, you'd have to tell. You'd have to tell the senator from Texas if you were going to plan the military coup.
If you insist.
That's one of the rules.
Guys, Cruz is on the line. How do we handle this? You got to tell them the truth.
All right. Folks, a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, it turns out Just Coffee apparently did so well with free shipping in the month of April. They have now made free shipping forever. And so if you ever listened to this and wondered, like, should I buy that coffee? But the shipping is prohibitive, or I don't know why you would ever say that, but if you ever did, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. I will talk later in the program. Apparently, my episode of WTF, where Mark Maron interviews me, is coming out Thursday. And I will talk about the email that he sent out that was pre-rude, I thought. I mean, I thought it was pre-rude. But we will talk about that. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. I'm going to take a quick break, come back with Professor Kevin Cruz. His book, One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program professor of history at Princeton University, author or co-editor of four books, including the award-winning White Flight. His latest, One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. Professor Kevin Cruz, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So let's start. I mean, it was really interesting. I found this book very interesting because, one, I think, I had known that the One Nation Under God, or the Under God on Our Money, I should say, it sort of came in the 50s. But I had always assumed it was really more a function of the Cold War. Your book discusses sort of the true origins of at the very least, this wave of sort of Christian America, and I think it also even more tellingly talks about the fusion of Christian values with sort of libertarian values. Where you start in Eisenhower's administration, but this story really sort of starts a little bit earlier.
That's right. And you know, when I came at this project, I had the same assumption you had. I think most people have, which is that all this stuff that comes about in the 1950s, it's a result of the Cold War. The standard story is, as America geared up to fight the godless communists of the Soviet Union, it draped itself in religious language formally for the first real time. And what I found, though, as I dug into the origins of this, of all these changes like Under God being added to the pledge, or In God We Trust becoming the national motto, all these things that happened in the 50s, I found out that they really were part of a much longer story that predated the Cold War. If you look at the private writings and even the public speeches of the people who engineer these changes, it's clear that the state power they're worried about isn't the Soviet regime in Moscow. It's the New Deal administration in Washington, D.C.
And who are those people that were afraid of the New Deal?
Well, it's you know, we might loosely call it, just call them big business. It's major corporate leaders of the top companies at the time, major business associations like the National Association of Manufacturers, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. From the start of the New Deal, they suddenly were put on the defensive. The New Deal was starting to regulate the economy for the first time seriously, more threatening to many of these businessmen. It had empowered labor unions really for the first time. So the workers were now on strike, rebelling against them as well. And so they start to push back very early on in the New Deal, and they start making these very kind of plain economic arguments about the necessity for free enterprise as an American value. But the problem is that the public doesn't buy what they're selling. There's a group called the American Liberty League, which is funded by bigwigs at GM and DuPont. But it's very obviously just business looking out for business. The head of the Democratic Party, Jim Farley, says they ought to call it the American Cellophane League because, number one, it's a DuPont product, and number two, you can see right through it. So once they realize that their own kind of naked arguments on economics aren't selling, they decide they need a new spokesman. And they look around and they realize that ministers are the most popular people in America. They say this in their private letters. So we need to get ministers to make this message for us. And that's what they do.
Okay, I mean, can we put this in context, too? I mean, because around that time, or I guess maybe a little bit earlier anyways, there is a the concern about the New Deal is significant enough that we had that sort of that famous business plot. Where Smedley Butler was supposed to march on Washington. Give us just that. I mean, when we see this plan to essentially say, like, how are we going to sell this to the American public? Is it a plan B? Is it just part of the same sort of like anxiety that is in the ether at that time by corporate America?
Yeah, it's part of the general anxiety. And so, you know, the people involved in this weren't, you know, tied to the kind of the extremist side of the Butler plot, but they feel the same, they feel the same anxieties. They really do feel like they're on the defensive, that free enterprise has been unfairly blamed for the Great Depression, that the welfare state is, and the regulatory state are usurping their natural rights to do business on their own terms. And they want to do everything they can to push back against that. And so they devote millions of dollars to this effort, and it's ultimately successful.
Yeah, I think at one point you talk about I can't remember what group it was, but they had a PR budget in, like, I think it was maybe it was NAM, the National Association of Manufacturers. They had a PR budget in early 1930s of virtually nothing, and then by the mid to late 30s, I think it's worth something like $14 million in today's money.
Yeah, they increased it over a span of 3 years. They increased their PR budget by 22 times. And they hire their first ever. They've been around for almost a half century. They hired their first ever director of public relations. It's something they suddenly take very serious because business has gotten a bad name for the first time ever. And they're really feeling the need to push back against this.
And it's really, I mean, I guess, I mean, I would imagine business hasn't gotten the bad name for the first time ever, but government is responding to it. I mean, so this is almost more about lobbying on some level.
Absolutely, absolutely. They're trying to both lobby, push back in politics, but also to push back the public opinion. They really want to convince ordinary Americans that the New Deal, which is incredibly popular at this time, is in fact working against basic American ideals. And this is why they bring ministers in, is because they want to make it clear. You know, people see that if the New Deal is just challenging people, you know, top corporate leaders, fine. But if they believe the New Deal is actually threatening basic American liberties and religious liberties being part of that, well, then suddenly it becomes a huge problem for most Americans.
So they bring in, or they attempt to sort of, I guess, recruit religious leaders. How well does that go at first anyways?
It goes pretty well at first. I mean, you know, there are large numbers of religious leaders who are supporting the New Deal because it is kind of enacting the so-called social gospel. But there are a number of ministers who are already tending to, you know, elite congregations who are already, you know, telling the ministers in their pews really what they want to hear. And they're very happy to join up in this cause. So a couple of them join up very readily.
So what's the relationship there? I mean, are they financially supported? Are they just taking on tours? I mean, what happens?
Incredible financial support. So James W. Fifield is a Congregationalist minister who funds this group called Spiritual Mobilization, which has an annual budget, again, in the late 30s, early 40s. By the late 40s, it's about $250,000 in 1940s money, an incredible amount today. Wow. And he uses this money to basically promote those business arguments. He engineers an ideology that comes to be known as a Christian libertarianism. And normal libertarianism doesn't have a religious angle to it. He puts libertarian arguments in a religious language. And he says, Christianity and capitalism are one and the same. They're both individual systems, individualistic systems in which people rise and fall on their own merits. And therefore, they're perfectly wedded. In any state that interferes with that natural order of things, as he says, a form of pagan statism, and we have to root it out.
Fifield's what I find really fascinating about Fifield is he had that quote that you look at the Bible like a fish. You pull out the right. bones. You don't eat the bones. You eat the meat. And you know, I heard once for some reason was interviewing a rabbi who could be considered, I guess, modern Orthodox. And they had said, you know, the Torah or the Bible is like a road map. If you get to a fork in the road that isn't on the map, you got to make your own decisions. But what's interesting to me about what Fifield did was that in some way he's simply substituting the dogma. Right. I mean, he's saying, like, you don't have to be a fundamentalist Christian, but the sort of payback is you got to be a fundamentalist marketeer, I guess, a free marketer.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, that's he has a very loose approach to the Bible. In fact, you can't be a fundamentalist and approach, you know, the teachings of Jesus Christ and come away with the idea that he's a big supporter of making it rich. You've got to kind of pick and choose. And so he has a loose approach there. He has a very strict interpretation of the Constitution, though, and that is, I think, what's truly important. And ultimately, the religious details aren't the most important thing for him or for his backers. It's the fact that they're advancing this common political message together.
Go more into that notion of him being a strict constructionalist, I guess, with the Constitution, because, I mean, on some level, there's so much that we see in movement conservatism today that seems to be sort of these themes that were worked out at this time.
Yeah, well, he believes, as many conservatives did, religious or not at this time, that, you know, the New Deal was overstepping the bounds of the Constitution. So before this kind of famous moment in 1937, when the Supreme Court stops striking down all these New Deal measures and starts giving the government a great deal of latitude in solving the economic crisis of the 1930s, that was the standard view. And it was a view that that wasn't really going back to the original view of the Constitution. It was a view that probably come into vogue a couple decades before, but it was the mainstream view that individual businesses had rights and they were largely free from government intrusion in their affairs. That's what he sought to protect.
Let me ask you, too, in terms of when Fifield starts to do this, because there's a couple other sort of major players in this movement. But around this time, you also had the fathers, I guess, of libertarian economics meeting at Mont Pelerin in 1947. Like, how much was this, again, just something that was in the air, or was there some sort of notion that, like, you know, we're on one hand we're developing sort of the ideology, on another hand we're developing the mechanism in which to disseminate this ideology?
It's a little of both. It's in the air, and so there's no direct linkage between those libertarians meeting in Mont Pelerin and the people that I'm talking about here, except for the fact that these Christian libertarians use the work of people like Hayek and von Mises, people who had no religious argument in their actual foregrounded in their actual books, and they marketed those books to ministers. They wanted to bring ministers over to this libertarian argument to convince them that it fit with the teachings of Christ. They were pushing back against that social gospel message that said that, you know, the New Deal was actually in keeping with Christ's teachings. And they're saying, no, free market capitalism is the way. So they take those libertarian books, those works that are being produced by the people at Mont Pelerin, and they market them quite literally. They're selling books, they're reprinting their their articles in a monthly magazine. They're quoting them in speeches. They get this in front of religious audiences and try to get them to listen to libertarian arguments.
So we have Fifield, who is a California pastor. He is pastoring to a lot of, I guess, millionaires and wealthy people. And so his message is tailored, sort of probably both comes out of being immersed in that world and tailored to that world. And tell us who Abraham Verity is. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right.
Verity, I think. Verity. Yeah. Abraham Verity is actually, people, your listeners might know his recent work. He's the founder of what's known as either the Fellowship or the Family. They run a house in D.C., which is often in the news when congressmen run into a personal scandal. They go there for counseling. But he gets his start, really, again, back in the mid-1930s. He gets his start. He's a Methodist minister in Seattle. He gets his start ministering to local businessmen who, again, feel besieged by the New Deal. When there are strikes in San Francisco and then in Seattle, huge labor strikes, again, not engineered, but enabled by the New Deal. He holds up literally in, kind of posh, the Pacific Union Club, other places like that, and leads them in prayer and tells them to stay the course, they'll weather the storm, they're doing God's will, they just need to resist this movement. So he starts in the 30s and he builds a national network of prayer breakfast groups that come out of that initial meeting in Seattle. They sweep across the country. And he has audiences with major corporate figures, IBM's Thomas Watson, the head of Quaker Oats, Chrysler, on and on and on. And then he brings this crusade to Washington, D.C. And in 1942, he's the one who founds the House Prayer Breakfast Group and the Senate Prayer Breakfast Group. And then a decade later, these become, under Eisenhower, the first national prayer breakfast, which we now have every year. It's an annual tradition.
And then where does Billy Graham fit into this?
Billy Graham's part and parcel of this whole Christian libertarian. We don't think of him that way, but he got his start in much the same way. His early backers, his patron was the richest oil man in the country, the richest man in the country, actually, a man named Sid Richardson. He gets his early start, Graham does, when major conservative publishers like William Randolph Hearst and Henry Luce start backing him in late 1949. And they all back Graham because he's preaching a message that, again, sounds just like these other ministers. He's telling them that businessmen are doing God's will. He says, they're working with God as a working partner. And he attacks over and over again the New Deal state, by this time led by Harry Truman, and labor unions in particular. He tells the Greensboro rally in 1952 that the Garden of Eden will be a paradise, with no labor leaders, no union dues, no snakes, and no disease. He calls upon labor leaders to lead their flocks to Christ, implying that no one who's in a union has religion. And so he goes on and on about this in so much, in such a spirited vein, that a London newspaper calls him the big business evangelist, because that's what his message sounds like. He's preaching for big business.
And does do these guys and others, do they feel like they're in competition with each other, or is there just enough money that is out there from big business interests to support all of their, I guess, enterprises or their ministries?
I think there's plenty to go around. There's a moment I don't talk about it directly in the book, but I discovered in researching that, Fifield, after a while, is getting tired. He's getting personal attacks. He tries to recruit Norman Vincent Peale to take over his job, and he almost gets him to succeed. But the problem is that Peale decides that he can make more money if he's still just writing his books and keeping his church in New York City. But there's plenty of support to go around, both financial and otherwise. And they actually, I think, they become emboldened by the others working in the same field. They feel like they're not alone. That they've got a growing movement here. I mean, it's in somewhat the same vein as the moral majority, right? The sense that there is a growing movement of outraged Christians out there, and we have the numbers. It's only a matter of time before we can push back and get this message through.
So then Dwight Eisenhower, I mean, I guess to a certain extent, this movement sort of sees Dwight Eisenhower as the guy who's going to I guess, ultimately, dismantle the New Deal. Tell us what Eisenhower does, at least from the sort of that when he came into office, that gave these folks some a measure of hope. And then ultimately, I mean, we know maybe we don't, but the story of the Dwight Eisenhower didn't exactly shrink the New Deal.
Right, right. Yeah, Eisenhower is again, part and parcel of this movement early on. It helps get him elected. Billy Graham's patron is Eisenhower's patron, Sid Richardson. Richardson spends about more than $1 million on Eisenhower's 1952 campaign. He's the one who introduces Graham to Eisenhower. Graham is supplying scripture on the campaign trail, and religious talk is a huge part of Eisenhower's campaign. Eisenhower writes the Credo of the American Way of Life for this group I talk about called the Freedoms Foundation, and it's a beautiful image in the book. It's these two stone tablets like the Ten Commandments, and one our political rights and one our business rights, and they both rest on this foundation of faith in God. And he uses this group to really to get elected. The Boy Scouts go out and put 30 million copies of that image on doorknobs across the U.S. The Saturday before the 52 election. So these Christian libertarians think that with Eisenhower's election, they finally won. They finally got a president in power who will use this religious language to push back against the New Deal. The problem is that Eisenhower very quickly makes peace with the New Deal. He writes a letter to his brother soon after he takes office in which he says, if any political party does away with Social Security or labor legislation and all the rest, you'll never hear from them again. He makes peace with the New Deal. In fact, he expands it. He pushes through an expansion of Social Security. He oversees the greatest post-war public works project, the interstate highway system. The top tax bracket in Eisenhower's entire term never falls below 92%. So he is very much making peace with the New Deal. That's why Goldwater later denounces the Eisenhower years as a dime store New Deal. It's a cheap copy. So he never uses that religious language to throw off the New Deal, that religious language that Christian libertarians had seen as a means to an end. He sees it as an end unto itself. And so he embraces that religious language, and he makes that one of his primary emphases, especially in his early months in office. He breathes this religious language into life and puts it into the heart of American politics.
I mean, he seems to I can't get quite get a grasp as to whether I mean, he seems sincere in terms of that belief. And he gets baptized shortly after getting into office. Was he aware that when he's running for office, is he aware that he's getting support from people who misperceive his Christianity or sort of like how he wants to manifest it?
No, he was very public about his Christianity. You know,
is he aware that there's some support out there thinking that his agenda is aligned with theirs in terms of the way that they would use Christianity to promote the free market?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think it lasts well through the election and after. He has a famous speech where he gets before that group I mentioned, the Freedoms Foundation, and it's when he's president-elect, and he says, you know, I've got a lot of requests to speak, but this is the one I sought out because I really believe in what you people are all about, and they were all about this idea of using this religious language and other methods to roll back the New Deal, to champion free enterprise. This is where he gives that famous quote that our system of government has no sense unless it is founded in a deeply felt religious faith, and I don't care what it is. Now, he gets mocked for that, but Eisenhower is, as William Lee Miller at Yale University says, a very fervent believer in a very vague faith. But I think that was actually Eisenhower's point. He knew you had to have this kind of vague religiosity to bring together Protestants and Catholics and Jews and other believers under this large religious tent. And that was the only way it would work at a national level.
But did he do you think that he changed his mind about the sort of the relationship between Christianity and the free market, or if he ever subscribed to that notion?
I think he still personally believes it, but once he's in office, I think he sees the writing on the wall. He realizes that it is political suicide to do away with Social Security, to do away with labor legislation, the way in which many of the supporters want it. And he points out, you know, I've cut back on some government regulations, I've loosened some government interference with the economy. That's in keeping with these earlier beliefs. But he very quickly makes his peace. And so I think it is a slight change of heart once he's in office. I don't think it's a con when he's running.
And but he does go on to sort of infuse, I guess, religion into not just politics, but sort of into the sort of the, almost to the bureaucracy of America.
Yeah, I mean, he comes out of the gate incredibly strong here. I mean, it's like we talk about FDR's first 100 days launching the New Deal. Eisenhower's first 100 days are really devoted towards this religious launch. It's from the inauguration. He reads a prayer that he wrote, which kind of stuns the country. He leads them in prayer personally. The first float in the inauguration is God's float. Early on in February, that week he gets baptized. That morning he gets baptized. That night he appears in the Oval Office, a televised address to the American Legion Back to God campaign. Later that same week, he hosts the very first national prayer breakfast. The very next day, he is the first prayers at a cabinet meeting. And his cabinet officers, as you say, wind that religion throughout the government. So the State Department, the Agriculture Department, all these executive agencies, the Pentagon, start to have religious ceremonies in which way they'd never had before. And so religion becomes woven into the government. It becomes, in Eisenhower's phrase, the motto of the very first national prayer breakfast, it becomes a government under God.
And you know, it's funny because I as I was reading, the notion of under God really does of saying one a nation under God, it really does say that. The state's laws are secondary, are subservient to God's laws, and then it's really sort of an argument, a fight as to how God's laws are defined, I guess, in terms of particularly in the context of, you know, do we roll back the New Deal? But so there was a on one hand. Well, let me ask you this: I mean, do you think that they? And they being these corporate, I guess, supporters of these, I don't know what to call them, free market ministries, I guess. Did they fail at that time and ultimately succeed? I mean, how do you rate the success of their project?
Well, in one way, it's a spectacular failure because, again, they'd hoped Eisenhower would roll back the New Deal, and instead he largely expands it. So in that way, in their immediate campaign, they failed. In terms of their larger impact, though, this is a story of unintended consequences. And so that campaign that they had waged to tear down the federal government actually winds up sanctifying it. It puts religion in there in a way in which I think otherwise wouldn't have happened to this degree, certainly hadn't happened before. All these markers of whether or not America's a religious nation, if you asked people in the street, they'd point to these things that happened in the 50s, the Pledge of Allegiance, the national motto, things like that. So they succeed tremendously in that point, but they had again seen that as a means to a much important end. So from their own you know, balance sheet, they failed. But as a story, not to say they made a huge difference on the nation.
I mean, don't you think, though, that to a certain extent, I mean, they may have failed in that sort of very narrow goal of rolling back the New Deal. But it seems to me, and I base this only on my experience in dealing with the conservative movement of today and over really the past 15 years or so, that all of those themes resonate, continue to resonate. And not only has it have those themes resonated in conservatism, but it also has functioned as an electoral wedge. I mean, because then we jump to, you know, the mid 70s when sort of that energy is then sort of, I guess, migrated to social and cultural issues. But the electoral power is still being used, it seems to me.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And so, you know, this new fusion of piety and patriotism that takes place in the 50s, it does wind up enabling and empowering social conservatives. And they do, as you know, wind up voting for Republicans. And the Republicans then do push back through the Reagan Revolution and beyond large measures of the New Deal state. So they do eventually get it. It's just a much more complicated chain reaction than what they thought they were going to get right up close with Eisenhower. It takes another 30 years before social conservatives are brought in with this language and other acts to become part of the Reagan coalition and thereby push it back. And we see it, you know, today, the arguments that these Christian libertarians had pushed about how corporations have certain religious liberties that can keep a regulatory state at arm's length. Well, we're seeing that in the courts now. The courts are finally starting to buy this with the Hobby Lobby decision. We saw it in Indiana with the religious liberty law there. There's a new effort to kind of bring these things that politically are incredibly old, but legally have had no purchase. They're starting to find purchase in the courts.
And I would argue that, frankly, the Tea Party movement is this same movement. I mean, it is not as, and maybe in some ways, not as sophisticated. But I spent a decent amount of time going to some of these rallies and talking to these people, and the same themes run throughout. The sort of the notion, not just that America is a Christian country, but the way that sort of religious MO of thinking. I mean, sometimes it's explicit to the point where, you know, I mean, I had a conversation with a woman who had traveled 8 hours to see Glenn Beck's, one of his Tea Party rallies, who basically said, you know, we need to have more, you know, we need to follow the Constitution more, and we need more religion in government. And I said, well, you know, that idea of separating those two things actually came from the Constitution. And she's like, well, I haven't actually read the Constitution yet, but I am taking a course on it in October. And this was this was in August. And I said, well, what if you find out that the Constitution doesn't say what you think it does? And she goes, oh, that might be a problem. I mean, so this sort of bringing these two things, like there's no difference between the Bible and the Constitution in her mind. She doesn't have to read probably either one of those documents to know this.
Right. Well, there's a large strand on the right even today that, I mean, I think didn't Mike Huckabee say recently that God wrote the Constitution? This idea is that whether or not that's literal or not, that the Constitution is somehow a religiously inspired document. You're right. I think it's still alive and well.
And in many respects, I think there's that notion that that Fifield had sort of said that you have more latitude in terms of reading the Bible in some ways than you do the Constitution sort of plays in here, because it sort of almost transfers that fundamentalist capacity for dogma and applies it to the sort of this economic, this sort of like this governmental realm.
I think that's a good reading. Yeah.
Well, it's a fascinating book and fascinating story. Kevin Cruz, author of One Nation Under God: How Corporate America Invented Christian America. We will obviously put a link to that book on majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Take care.
Bye bye. Still haven't put in that custom Skype ring. Fascinating. I'm convinced, and I think there were other moments in our history where we saw sort of this integration of specifically Christian and, I don't know, governmental perspective. A message, but I think they may have failed with Eisenhower to reverse the New Deal, but I would think these titans of industry from that time would be relatively happy with the way their project bore out.
Clearly.
No, I think, I mean, look, and it's not just so much of our politics is shaped by this dynamic. And these days it comes in the form less of, although I think it's still embedded there, in this notion of Christian and libertarian ideology. I mean, just look at Ron Paul, right? I mean, they're libertarian until really you're talking about things that sort of bump up against sort of explicit religious doctrine. And they have to do flips about it and turn into neo-Confederates. Well, marriage equality should really be about the states. abortion is really about inhibiting freedom for a fetus, on and on. But certainly, in terms of leverage, and in terms of, you know, whatever that 30% is out there that Mike Huckabee is really, really hoping to garner. We will talk more about Huckabee and Carly Fiorina and Carlson, Ben Carlson. Is that his name? Carson. Gosh, I'm gonna need like a scorecard for these guys. I think Ben Carson, we really should actually have an extended conversation about who is going to be the most fun to follow. I mean, think about this. If you're Ted Cruz, what do you do at this point? Like, you're sort of surrounded. You can't go full on God Squad because Huckabee seems to be basically sitting over there. You can't go full on Obama's actual Nazi because that's where, you know, Ben Carson is there. You certainly can't go, hey, I'm just a guy who wants to get things done, because that's no way your brand.
Lame.
He's going to have to come out with something like completely.
He's going to have to do all of the above better than the rest of them.
I just don't think there's room. I think he's going to have to come out with something different. No, I don't know what it could be. He's going to have to do something. I don't know what it's going to be. Like, maybe he'll just like claim, like at one point, like, I can do magic. I have magic powers. Or maybe he just says, like, he's going to come out and he's going to...
A Christian that can fly.
Yes. Or maybe he's going to come out and say, I'm actually gay. And I'm coming out. I don't know. Like, I don't think that would work for him.
I think he would lose. I'm gay and I've suppressed it so well that I have several children with my wife.
Right.
In your face.
Right.
And then Ben Carson might come by and be like,
it's going to be.
Did you spend some time in prison?
Yeah. That's not necessarily that distinguishing.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. We got plenty to talk about. This story about the FEC, and it goes hand in hand with what we were talking about earlier. I guess I should say last week. I think Cliff and I brought this up, that what Jeb Bush is doing is he is not declaring that he's a president, running for president, in any or even, vaguely speaking. And he's doing this basically so that he can continue to raise money for his super PAC, which he is planning to delegate to much of what a traditional campaign would do. So the FEC is a disaster right now, the Federal Elections Commission. It's a disaster. And really, I mean, I don't know, and maybe I'm just deluded to even contemplate the notion that one or two of those conservative justices could look into the mirror one day and just go, boy, I've really, like, personally, I went into work one day and I totally effed up the country in a way that it might be impossible to rewind. And that's, you know who had that moment? Sandra Day O'Connor, I think.
Yes, definitely.
I actually think that Sandra Day O'Connor had that moment where she realized, when we put George Bush in office, I personally may have fatally effed up the country. I mean, just think about that for a moment, because, you know, we all have some complicity in everything that's effed up about this country, because we all vote, we all pick. Most of us vote.
Are you willing?
We all pay taxes.
That well, I get a refund.
Sandra
but
O'Connor
but,
is a hypocrite. And I'd also like to say that you're, that you're smug.
All right. Well, but the point is,
you're a coward.
Sandra Day O'Connor is one of the few people in the country. Anthony Kennedy may be another.
I didn't
who can
vote
actually
to confirm
look.
Sandra Day O'Connor. I'm not in the United States Senate.
They'll look in the mirror and say, like, wow, I really had the opportunity to change the arc of history in this country and for the world. All right, well, we're going to take a break.
Are you willing to admit now that you're a hypocrite?
If you want to call me up, tell me that I'm a hypocrite.
Oh, please do.
646-257-3920. If you want to call up and defend libertarian ideology, 646-257-3920. If you want to call up and tell me why Carly Fiorina should be president, I wouldn't even necessarily argue with you. I'm just curious as to what that answer could possibly be.
We would just listen. If you're looking forward to voting for Ben Carson, please call this program.
I cannot guarantee you that I will not refute some of what you say, because I would guess if you're a supporter of Ben Carson, you believe things that are rather interesting. But 646-257-3920 is the number. Our IM, Majority FM at AOL. You can IM through our app, which I hope you've picked up by now. It's free. Go to majorityapp.com. iOS, Android. Don't forget the myriad of ways of supporting us. Oh, I will. Maybe I'll wait till Thursday to talk about this email from Marin, because that's the day that he releases the WTF thing. But I was... Wow. I mean, have I ever, even like when I have like Professor Block on, Walter Block, or even like when, what's that guy? Peter Schrift or Schrift or Short Schrift. We have people like that on. I don't insult them the way that Marin seems to have insulted me in announcing that I was the guest on his 600th episode. This, incidentally, is our, I don't know what, 1,500, 1,200, 1,300? Done more than double than Marin. Thank God we're in a volume business. All right, we'll be right back after that.
You can take him to your court, and he can take him to court.